Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. On the program today, we will return to an issue that we have talked about on the program before, most specifically a couple of weeks ago, and that is tort reform, something that President Bush says will be a major objective for his next term, something I'm sure that we'll be talking about a lot next year. We wanted to hear, as we were closing out this year, to at least do a couple of programs to give you a preview and give you the opportunity to hear arguments on both sides of the issue. According to the Republican Party platform of this past summer, frivolous lawsuits are driving up the cost of doing business by forcing companies to fight or to settle often baseless lawsuits. And just recently, just last week, President Bush made the point again, saying that he was passionate about protecting the business community from, quote, frivolous lawsuits, unquote. He said he'd work hard to get legal reform through Congress, including making the issue a topic of his State of the Union address next month. Just a couple of weeks ago on the program, you heard from Sherman Joyce, president of the American Tort Reform Association. That was on November 30th. This morning, we'll have a different set of views as we talk with Frank Clementi. He is director of Public Citizens Congress Watch and has been since 1996. Public Citizens Congress Watch conducts public education and advocacy efforts on a number of issues, including campaign finance reform, better access to quality health care, legal reform issues, corporate accountability, and also regulatory issues that relate to health, safety, and the environment. Before that, for 6 years, our guest Frank Clementi was senior policy advisor to the House Committee on Government Operations, chaired by Representative John Conyers, overseeing a number of initiatives involving everything from national health care to environment to budget policy. He was also issues director for Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign in 1988 and has directed or served as senior advisor to several congressional campaigns and local initiatives. As we talk in this hour of focus, questions and comments are certainly welcome. All you have to do to participate in the conversation is pick up the telephone and call in. And the only thing that we ask of people who call simply is that people are brief, and we just ask that so we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. Of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call in with their comments. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good to anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or you might even happen to be listening on the Internet, you can use that that toll-free line as long as you're in the United States. That is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. Clementi, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm great.
Good. We appreciate you giving us some of your time. We already have a couple of callers, and of course, as we go along, I expect we'll have some people to talk with. But first, just as an overview on the issue, let's talk a little bit about your take and Public Citizens' take on the issue of tort reform. And obviously, you have a fundamental disagreement with the administration, with other groups that are making the argument for reform. You seem to have a very fundamental disagreement about where the problem actually lies and if indeed there is a problem.
Yes. We actually prefer to call it tort deform. That's our way of saying reform implies a good change and most of the time, and we think this is not a good change. We think that it's a people's legal rights are very fundamental in this country. It creates a level playing field, whether it's with respect to the insurance companies, the health maintenance organizations that provide you with health care, or the large drug companies that manufacture defective drugs, or car companies that their cars end up being recalled because of defects. Often those defects kill people. Or, you know, telemarketing companies that call up and particularly prey on senior citizens and rip them off through telemarketing scams. All of these types of problems that people face, they try and redress them through the legal system, through this torts. Torts is it's a case one brings in civil court against these companies, or in some cases against professionals like doctors if they've harmed you in some way. And we feel very strongly that this is a It's an important part of our democracy. It levels power in our economy. The person of the least means, if they've been seriously harmed, they can bring a company to be held accountable in court before a jury and judge for damages, and they can force major changes in company behavior so that products end up being safer, things like that. So we just see this as a very important foundation of our economy and of our society. And our view is that the people who are trying to take away people's legal rights, which is what we believe they're trying to do, it's not, they use the rationale of economic reasons for doing it, but it's really not an economic matter. It's largely a political matter. They are trying to, those folks who want to take away people's legal rights are coming down on the side of large special interests and not on the side of average consumers or medical patients, in our opinion.
As I said, I have a couple of callers. I want to get onto them, and I want to tell those people I won't make them wait forever. But let me just ask one further question specifically about the kind of changes that are proposed coming under the heading of reform, what some people would call reform. The basic things seem to be that they would like to see a cap placed on what are called non-economic damages. That's customarily the kinds of things that perhaps people are used to thinking of or referring to as damages awarded for pain and suffering. They want to put a limit on attorneys' fees, and in many of these cases, the attorneys collect some percentage of the damages that are awarded to the plaintiff. And then there's also a requirement that people would receive their damage payments in installments rather than having to the whoever is paying out those damages to make those payments in a lump sum. And there are, of course, some other things, but those seem to be sort of the major things.
Yeah.
And I guess that the people who talk about reform would say something like, well, we're not trying to take away from people the opportunity or the ability to sue. They're still going to be able to bring lawsuits if that's what they want to do. We're just trying to make it a little bit easier, more reasonable perhaps, for those people who end up having to pay out the damages. And also they would claim that in trying to limit attorney's fees that they're also trying to do something for the plaintiffs. And so much of the money that they receive won't have to go to lawyers. I guess at the end of the day they would say, you know, we're trying to make some changes, but we're not certainly trying to take away from people the ability to file these kinds of lawsuits.
Well, I think those are three. We could. I'm not sure I can get into the particular three points that you said that they raise. I think the important framework, though, for your listeners to understand is that the folks proposing these changes are not consumer organizations. They're not seniors groups. They're not healthcare organizations. They're not folks who are typically on the side of your average patient or consumer. They are business entities, whether it's major corporations, major drug companies, major insurance companies, Chamber of Commerce, which is leading the fight on a lot of this stuff because of, you know, its large company membership. So I think that's the first important framework, is that you have a lot of folks. I think we have 4,000 or 5,000 members in Illinois who are members of Public Citizen, and we're fighting for consumers, the average person. The other side, Bush, President Bush, and the other folks are fighting for the people being sued, because it's a hassle to be sued. Nobody likes to be held accountable. Nobody likes to be forced to change your product or recall your product because you were careless in how you manufactured it. And no doctor likes to be brought into court to be held accountable. It's a very painful experience. It's time. It costs a lot of time and money and this and that. If you want, we could talk through the cap on damages, attorney's fees, and the installment payment issue. I can get into some detail on that. It's tell me what you'd like.
Well, I tell you what, why don't we just hold that for a minute, and so we'll go to the callers, and then we'll come back to those issues.
Sure.
We have callers here, a couple of them, and we'll start out, I believe, with a caller in over listening in Indiana this morning on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I sure hope you get to those subjects you just mentioned. My first instance when I heard a group of people had a speaker against the tort, in a sense, have the tort reform and wanted to cap things, is they made the trial lawyers sound almost like God in some way, that they can sway a jury to do about anything. Then later on in their program, they made the jury sound sort of stupid because they didn't quite understand, you know, what the prosecutor or whatever was saying. And I, first thing that came to my mind, it's the first attack on the jury system. I wondered if you could speak to that rather nebulous view. And thanks a lot, and good show again.
All right, well, thank you. Well, you can go ahead and do that, Mr. Clementi.
Sure, yeah. I mean, some folks believe in the jury system. Probably most Americans believe strongly in the jury system, and others don't. I think anybody who's participated in a jury, I've been on one, not on a personal injury case, but on a criminal case. It's a fascinating process, and a process I respect greatly because it's people really try hard to do the right thing, to be fair, to weigh all the evidence, and they come to a reasonable conclusion. And that's the system we have in all 50 states when it comes to these tort issues. It's they're civil trials, they're not criminal trials, but the jury decides, and you know, all this evidence gets presented, and some of it is technical, and some of it is not technical, but is very you know, very much who this person is and what this person's life experiences are. And unless we're going to totally change that process, I think we need to respect it and continue it. I think it works very well. The fact is, and this is one of the confusing things about the tort system, most cases do not go to a jury. And in fact, in medical malpractice, for instance, only about 5% of cases end up before a jury. They are either settled beforehand, and most cases aren't settled, frankly. Often what happens, you have to, this is all at different levels. People say, there's all these cases. Well, the fact is, you go to a lawyer and you give them some information about your case. They open a file on you if they think the case has any merit whatsoever. They then go to the insurance company and say, well, we're doing some research, we're doing some discovery, we're trying to determine if there's a case here or not. So that's a case that gets open with the insurance company. Now, often after the process proceeds for some months, the lawyer for the person who's been injured will decide this case isn't worth pursuing, it's too hard to prove, there's not sufficient damages, you know, it's not an economic case, it's not worth it for me to put my time in it, any number of things. But all those go into this consideration of whether to bring a case or not. But the fact is that almost 95% of cases are not jury cases. They are decided outside. They're either taken away. In other words, the lawyer decides I'm not going to continue pursuing it, or the insurance company for the defendant will settle the case based on what they think is the case is worth, based on what their risk is taking it to trial. If they try and settle it too low and they're forced to go to trial, there often is a concern that at trial they will have to pay a higher damage.
All right. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Let's go here to somebody else. This is line number one here in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
That answer actually was so relevant because the arguments tend to be highly emotional ones, the argument of incompetence, excessive pain on one side or the other, economic damage to our entire system, and the bringing down of our culture, basically. And so actual numbers, if they're available, would make a lot of difference. And so apropos of that, and back to this question of whether this is an economic issue, could you give us your opinion of the argument that I've heard raised that in this specific case of insurance premium skyrocketing, so-called, it has less to do with the actuarial requirements of paying out claims, damages, settlements, whatever the numbers are, and more to do with the lack of return on investment, as in the last 4 or 5 years, of the insuring companies, that when they can't get enough because out of the investments, they begin raising the rates to make up for it. And if that figure is accurate, if that argument is accurate, I'm wondering how it is that there is no free market in insurance where they actually compete for business by offering the lowest possible rates. I want another question, if I may, so please address the question of insurance rates skyrocketing.
What the caller is referring to, we call it the insurance cycle. People need, your listeners, it's important to distinguish between what I call the kind of red-hot rhetoric that is out there on this subject. And honestly, it starts with the politicians, and it's the business community is pushing it, and it kind of filters down. I mean, first of all, the overlay on this is there's a general predisposition in our society against lawyers. They used to say dentists were the most hated profession. I think nowadays lawyers are the most hated profession. And, you know, these lawyers who defend consumers are disparaged throughout the news media. And I think that's a whole separate conversation and an important point, because what it does is it biases how we all look at this. And what the bias pervades to this question of the malpractice insurance crisis. There is a spike that has occurred in the last 2 or 3 years in the amount that doctors have to pay for medical malpractice insurance. That's insurance to protect them should they be sued. What people don't understand, if you get outside the daily newspaper or outside the rhetoric, and you actually go and read the journals and the trade publications that come from the insurance industry itself, what that industry talks about is the insurance cycle. They don't talk about these rates are skyrocketing because damages are up, the number of lawsuits are up, anything like that. They talk about it as it's an economic cycle, the same way as the larger business cycle. Sometimes our economy goes into recession, sometimes it comes out, most of the time it's out of recession. It's the same way with the insurance market. Most of the time the insurance market is doing very well, very large profits are being made, and periodically, once every 10 years or so, it goes into a tailspin where it loses its profitability. There's market share problems, and they have to, in order to get profitable again, the companies have to spike their rates to make up for their investment losses. And that is what has taken place in the insurance market the last few years. It was exacerbated it really began with insurance companies were making huge amounts of money in the 1990s. They were cutting their rates fairly dramatically in order to, because it was competitive, they were trying to get more business. Why were they doing that? Because they were making a lot of money in the bond market and the stock market. That's where they make their money. They make it on investments. So they cut their rates, so they put themselves in a precarious financial position, which was fine as long as they were getting this big investment return. But when the investments collapsed, as we all know, if some of us are fortunate to have a 401k or, you know, a money market account, whatever, you know, we weren't doing too bad before the crash either. Well, suddenly we're doing bad too, just like the insurance companies are doing bad. We don't have the ability to charge a higher price. The insurance companies do, and that's what they've done.
Did the caller have another question that he wanted to ask?
Yes, if I can ask
a
separate one.
Sure.
This will get us back, as the last caller requested, to those items in the details of the so-called reform. If you could actually have tort reform, let's try to be a little positive now, what items would you prefer in a reform of the current system? If you couldn't get exactly what you wanted, what would you propose as a quid pro quo if you agreed to any of the items suggested currently? What would you balance it with? It's sort of like I'll cut the pie into pieces and you get to be the first pick, so everybody gets something and has an incentive for fairness. Are there things you would prefer in actual tort reform? And if you can't get that, what would you suggest to balance each one of the individual suggestions that are now proposed? And to answer the previous caller's question, you could go into each one of those things that are now proposed. And I think I've had enough time. I'll hang up and listen.
You got a very skilled questioner here. I'll try and answer it quickly. Most of the time we're fighting what I call a defensive battle. People are trying to, companies, Congress is trying to take away our rights. and so we're trying to protect those. And we have trouble our view is the tort system is largely a state-by-state system. It's a body of law that's been developed state-by-state, and so we're a little uncomfortable imposing federal standards on all this. The two most important things from our point of view, though, is for patients who are in a health maintenance organization, a managed care company, that is regulated by a federal law. They are regulated by a federal law. In many cases, it's called ERISA. It's a complicated law. It's not worth going into. But the fact is, people remember the debate a couple of years ago about the patient's bill of rights. What that was a whole bunch of different things, but most fundamentally it was, should people have additional legal rights so that they can bring cases against health maintenance organizations, managed care companies, because they deny you medical care? Right now, because of the legal situation, it's virtually impossible to bring such a case at your state level. It's preempted by this federal ERISA law. Essentially, it cuts your legal rights off to bring a case against these companies if they've denied you medical care. So that's probably the first important thing I would change to help consumers. The second thing is, it's an insidious effort by the business community. What they do, the issue broadly is called mandatory arbitration clauses. If you have a credit card, your phone company, you buy a particular kind of product, there's a contract. You typically probably don't read it. I don't read it. But in the fine print of that contract, it basically says, if you have a dispute with this company, the only way you can resolve it is by going to mandatory arbitration. Essentially, you can't go to court, the public legal system, where it's an even playing field. They say you have to go to mandatory arbitration. And mandatory arbitration is private. It's controlled by the company who you have this agreement with. And often what that means is they choose who the arbitrator is. They can have an arrangement with an arbitration service. There's substantial upfront costs to go into arbitration that you would have to bear, whereas if you're in the tort system, the regular legal system, your lawyer actually pays for those upfront costs. And so we would like to stop, the federal government to basically say that these mandatory arbitration clauses in these contracts, to basically prohibit them. These clauses are in your agreement with your insurance company, your health maintenance organization, with your auto dealer. If you have stock and you work with a securities company, you know, to buy and sell your stocks, they have these kinds of agreements. They literally foreclose your legal rights in court. You have to go to this private system, and our view is that private system is largely stacked against people.
We have a number of callers, so we'll continue to talk with folks. I think I should also reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Frank Clementi. He is director of Public Citizens Congress Watch and has been since 1996. Congress Watch conducts public education and advocacy efforts on a number of issues, including campaign finance reform, better access to health care, legal reform issues, corporate accountability, and other things. We're talking this morning about tort reform. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the Bush administration has said this is going to be a priority of its next term. And Mr. Bush said that again last week, where he said he would work very hard to get this reform through Congress. It would be a big issue in his State of the Union address that he will be delivering next month. And it's something that I'm sure that we'll be talking about next year and perhaps beyond. But we did want, at least this fall, do a couple of programs looking at the issues. On November 30th, we talked on this program with Sherman Joyce, who is president of the American Tort Reform Association, an organization that favors tort reform. And we also wanted to give you the opportunity to hear some other arguments, some sort of counter arguments. And for that, we have Mr. Clementi with us this morning. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I did want to ask you, because the caller asked about, well, where, you know, are there some things that you would like to see in the way of reform that's perhaps different from the kind of reform that the Bush administration and others are talking about? You have on the Public Citizen website some papers and some information, sort of policy papers on your take on these issues, and people can go to publiccitizen.org and look at them. One of the points that you make in one of these is that, in fact, at least from your perspective, you think that the problem here may not really be lawsuits filed by individuals, that in fact businesses file many more lawsuits than do individuals, and it may be that the problem here are businesses filing frivolous lawsuits, not individuals filing
right.
frivolous lawsuits. Would you like to see any limits placed on the ability of businesses to file suits?
No. First of all, our website is it actually isn't Public Citizen. It's citizen.org.
Pardon me. That's right. Yes,
oddly
right, yeah.
enough, I don't know why we don't do Public Citizen, but anyway, citizen.org.
Citizen.org, yeah.
And the report you're referring to is called Frequent Filers. The report actually has the information from Cook County, Illinois. What we did was we decided to look at the question of the number of lawsuits that are filed. How often do businesses file lawsuits versus individuals file lawsuits? And let's face it, there's a heck of a lot more Americans than there are businesses in the country. Probably, I don't know, 40 times as many people in the country as there are businesses. The interesting thing we found, there's really only two states and two counties where this information is able to be collected and analyzed in a similar way, and one of them happens to be Cook County, Illinois. And what we found was that businesses were filed four times as many suits as individuals do. And actually, another part of the study, which was even more surprising, the president and others talk about frivolous lawsuits. And there's actually a federal process where a federal judge can sanction either a defendant or a plaintiff. They can sanction them for filing a frivolous lawsuit. It's called Rule 11. And we actually went back and looked at all the sanctions under Rule 11. All the sanctions for frivolous motions or filings in the last, it actually went back till 2001, and we found that businesses were much more likely to be sanctioned by a federal judge than an individual with an attorney bringing a civil case. So that was kind of very counterintuitive as well. Businesses are actually sanctioned much more often for filing frivolous cases than individuals are. I'm not interested in restricting lawsuits. I mean, I just don't believe that that's what we should be about. Look at business, and there's lots of, I mean, I got a list, long list of frivolous business cases, but if businesses feel that they have been wronged, they've been ripped off by another business, they got lousy service or whatever, they should be able to bring a lawsuit. And I don't think that you can legislate that. You know, it's just not. I mean, there are sanctions in place that state judges and federal judges can bring if a case is frivolous, and it's incumbent upon them to issue those sanctions if they feel that the case or the motions or whatever are frivolous. But I don't think that we should be pushing legislation, or legislators should be legislating. It's too hard to do.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones here. The next caller is in Indianapolis, line number 4.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to ask a couple of questions, one having to do with the businesses suing individuals, because you have companies suing people for downloading music or movies and then extorting money from those individuals without any proof that they've done anything wrong. I think this is an example of a frivolous lawsuit that should be dealt with definitely by the Bar Association or somebody. And my second point is, we already have malpractice reform in Indiana where you have a limit on pain and suffering. It's been a law for years, and maybe you're right, it should be done on a state-by-state basis. But my third point is, what about these class action lawsuits where these law firms will solicit you to be part of a class action suit, and then they spend a lot of money suing a corporation, sometimes winning millions of dollars, and then you, the consumer, guess what? You get a $5 coupon for the damages done to you, and they reap the millions of dollars. I mean, if this isn't ripe for reform, I don't know what is.
The class action issue is it's an important one because it's happening in Congress. It's been going on here the last couple of years, and it'll be front and center. It may be the first piece of legislation on tort issues that Congress deals with. what this refer, what a, let me just explain what a class action is. You know, General Electric Company. You have let's take an insurance company, a life insurance company. Maybe 10,000 people across the country, or 500 people in a particular state, purchased the same type of life insurance, and there was a hidden fee in that life insurance contract. You weren't made aware of that fee. It was a fee that maybe only cost you a small amount of money, but when you add it up for all the people who bought those life insurance policies, it adds up into the millions of dollars. So a lawyer, a plaintiff, an individual might find out about it. They were being overcharged. This often happens on phone bills, on mortgage agreements, et cetera. Or an entrepreneurial lawyer might discover that this large company was ripping off consumers. Now, typically what it is, it's a relatively small amount of money. In some cases, it can be thousands of dollars. There's these very large cases. Defective pipe was sold by a company, and it went into thousands of homes across the country, and people had to completely rip out their piping because after a few years it started leaking. That was worth thousands of dollars to those individual homeowners. Similarly, occasionally, defective siding gets put on houses. It deteriorates dramatically in the weather. People have to rip it off. The weather hurts the underside of their house, and then they have to replace it. Those things are worth many thousands of dollars. There's lots of these other cases that are smaller. Typically, you'd call them nickel and dime cases because, you know, maybe 10, 20, 100 bucks they're worth, not more than that. It's easy to say that in those cases, the lawyers are getting $3 million and I'm only getting 10 bucks. I think people have to put it in perspective. They have to see, well, it's 10 bucks for me, but if you multiply it times 100,000 people, that's $10 million. And so that's the first thing I would say about these cases. You got to see it for not just you as the one class member, but you as one among 100,000 class members. The second thing is that these cases, these class actions, seek to discourage future bad behavior by corporations. So they send a very strong signal. You may get caught, and you may be on the hook for $10 million later on. The third thing is a point I would agree with the caller on. There are some law firms, some attorneys, who we believe act improperly. They bring class action cases. The cases will often be very meritorious. In fact, in most cases, if not, they're very meritorious. But the attorneys negotiate a bad settlement for the consumers. They're ripping off the consumers. The consumers might get a coupon settlement. You often hear of that. What that is it's a coupon. Instead of you getting your 10 bucks, that's your share, you might get or 100 bucks or 500 bucks, you might get a coupon to buy a product from the same company that ripped you off. Man, does that make your blood boil. And Public Citizen, actually, for a number of years now, has spent a lot of time with our lawyers opposing these coupon class action settlements because we think they are not in the interests of consumers. It is easy to fix the coupon class action problem, to put up some roadblocks so that attorneys have no incentive. You can tie how much attorney gets with how much the coupon is redeemed. And I guarantee you, they won't do many coupon settlements because consumers don't want to redeem them when they get ripped off. They want the little money in their pocket that's their share. So there's this big debate in Washington that's going to occur in the next Congress in January, February, about class action bill, and the Chamber of Commerce and the business community will say, stop coupon settlements. Really what that bill is about is not stopping coupon settlements. In fact, that was never dealt with in their legislation until we pointed out their hypocrisy on it. what it is about is making it harder for you as an individual consumer who gets ripped off by a large company to band together into these class action cases and bring it and hold these companies accountable.
Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller, and I have some other folks I want to get onto, and time is rapidly moving along here. We're moving on to our last 15 minutes. But let me ask real quick again. It seems that we're coming back to what is for a lot of people a central issue, and that is the amount of money that attorneys can make representing clients in these cases. And that gets us back to what for a lot of people I think is the major thing that they'd like to see happen under reform, and that is to caps on not only caps on damages, but caps on limits on the amount of money that attorneys can collect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and let's talk about that. And if we could, I would like to reserve some time to talk about caps on damages, because it really is a central debate.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
On the attorney's fees question, look, I know when you sit out here and you look at it and you see, well, here this attorney's going to get a third. Say, in my case, I might get $300,000 for the injury that I've suffered. Well, that means the attorney's going to get a third. They're going to get I'm going to get $200,000. I'm the one who's injured. They're going to get $100,000. That sounds very inequitable to me. Here's the reality on this situation. These attorneys take these cases for free. You have no upfront costs. All their time is paid for by themselves, by their law firm. They go through lots of depositions, the investigative period. They hire expert witnesses. In a serious medical malpractice case, that can cost you tens of thousands of dollars to have expert witnesses. Anyway, for an important case, they might spend $50,000 to $100,000 up front out of their own pocket for that particular case. You're not being charged a cent. On top of that, at least half of these cases, they don't win. They don't get a settlement. They don't get a jury award. And they're running their business. So you have to understand, this award is paying for them to run their business. It's paying for all the costs that they've shelled out up front. And it's paying not just for those cases that they, quote, win. It's also paying for all those cases they lose. And believe me, they lose a lot of cases. Not because they're not meritorious cases. You can see the dynamic here. You'd be crazy to bring, quote-unquote, frivolous lawsuits, because you would fast go out of business because you're the guy who's putting all the costs up front. The plaintiff's not on the hook. Usually what it is the plaintiff wants you to bring a case, the person who's been injured wants you to bring a case, and you look at it and you say, well, it's frivolous, I'm not going to bring it, or it's not worth enough money. So usually the attorneys are rejecting those cases that are lesser important, lesser value, what you might define as less important. I don't want to use the word frivolous, because the cost of bringing these cases is so high. The second point about this is about the attorney's fees question is, if you don't, this is a way for the rich people can afford lawyers. They can afford to shell this money out up front. It's painful, but for most of us, we don't have those kinds of resources. We need a system where somebody's willing to pay for it up front, take the risk, put the investment into it to get you justice. And if you take away, if you cap fees at this much lower level, which is what the other side wants to do, you're going to take away a big incentive for these attorneys, and you, believe me, you want the best attorney to bring these cases, to even be involved in these kinds of cases. There will be an incentive for them, for the better attorneys in particular, to shift out of this what's called the contingency fee system, where they're totally on the hook until the case is won, to just going and working for corporations and getting a standard hourly rate. Now, I know I want, if I'm injured, my family is injured, I want the best lawyer, and I want to be able to have them take the case. If you lower how much they can make off that case, there are going to be many fewer lawyers bringing these cases, and that's just a way to stop justice for people in general.
We have several callers here. We'll continue our guest in this part of Focus 580, Frank Clemente. He's director of Public Citizens Congress Watch. We're talking about tort reform. It's the second of two programs we've done this fall on the issue. I'm sure we'll be talking about it more next year on the program. If you're interested, by the way, in hearing the preview show, and you do have internet access, you can hear the conversation we had November 30th with Sherman Joyce, president of the American Tort Reform Association, on our website. It's WILL.UIU. iuc.edu. We have other callers here, and next, someone in Chicago, line two. Hello.
Good morning. The June or July issue of Reader's Digest had an article on medical malpractice, and there were two important points in the article. The first was that 5% of all physicians incur about 51% of all the medical malpractice suits. And secondly, that if the art of the horrific cases that they highlighted in the article, all of those physicians were still practicing. So the general thrust of the article was that the AMA or the associations of physicians are not monitoring themselves, and that these 5% of the physicians who are incurring more than half of the lawsuits are able to go on practicing and continuing to incur cases. And as you, I think you mentioned this earlier, most of the time they settle rather than going to court so that they can say, if charged, well, I have no judgments against me. And so is your organization at all talking with these professional organizations and seeing what they could do to monitor themselves? Because, you know, if you think that only 5% of all physicians incur more than 50% or slightly over 50% of all the medical malpractice suits, that seems almost like a problem that the AMA would be able to take care of themselves.
Yeah, you know, this is actually our data. That's our figure, and it's based on the U.S. government has a thing called the National Practitioners Data Bank, and what it is insurance companies are required to report to the federal government when they make a payment for a physician, a malpractice payment for a physician. And we push this patient safety issue very hard. The important thing about that 5% of doctors, it's actually more like 55% of payments now. That 5%, they don't just have one malpractice payment. Each of those doctors has at least two malpractice payments, so they're repeat offenders. And you know, three of them account for a very large. Those who have three or more malpractice payments account for a very large percentage as well. What the caller is getting at is really the cost of the medical malpractice system. And most people think, well, what the cost is, you know, what the doctors pay for insurance rates. The Institute of Medicine did a very important study a couple of years ago called To Err is Human. And they said there's 48,000 to 98,000 deaths a year just in hospitals. And those deaths are preventable deaths. In other words, the hospital and its personnel could have prevented that person from dying. Extrapolated to Illinois, that means you have about 1,900 to 4,300 deaths every year in hospitals that are preventable. And it costs you, again, the Institute of Medicine extrapolating to Illinois, it costs your state for these medical errors in hospitals alone anywhere from $750 million to $1.3 billion every year. Those are very sizable dollar costs and deaths, not to mention the toll that occurs to families. We think that it's remarkable to us that the medical society doesn't come together with patient safety groups and consumers and say, we're going to stop the bad doctors, the repeat offended doctors. We're going to create policies to change it. Let me give you the thing that we push, and I hate to say people haven't taken it up yet. The American Society of Anesthesiologists, major professional society for anesthesiologists. They're the folks who put you to sleep in hospitals when you go in for surgery. They used to be sued more often than any other profession, any other medical profession, because people died, people were injured from anesthesiology. Now, they went through a major program to figure out what their doctors were doing wrong. They hired academics to examine all the closed files, the malpractice case files that have been filed against them. They got them from the insurance companies. These medical professionals looked at it, figured out what was going wrong. They developed a protocol list for the procedures, all the checklist of the right things they should do and the wrong things they should avoid when they're treating people. They cut the number of lawsuits filed against them got cut in half over the last two decades, and their malpractice insurance rates today are the same as they were 20 years ago. $18,000 on average. A huge patient safety initiative. And my question is, why isn't the American Medical Association, which is based in Illinois, and the insurance companies, why aren't they getting together and doing the same thing for obstetrics, surgeons, all the key medical professional groups to get sued? Why aren't they doing that instead of trying to take away people's legal rights?
Thank you. That's a good question.
Well, thank you for the call. We'll go on here to next person in line. This is a listener in Urbana. It's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, actually, my question was very close to the one of the previous caller. It seems to me that medical malpractice is where tort reform almost always comes up. And it seems to me to disregard the fact that while every state has some kind of board of doctors to examine medical malpractice, most of them never take any action. And it seems to me this is quite in line with the inability of most professions not to be able to police themselves. And the lawyers are doing this for us fairly effectively.
That's a good, that's an interesting way. I mean, our health research group, Public Citizens Health Research Group, every few years does a study on how good state medical boards are at policing what we call dangerous doctors, bad doctors, doctors that make make mistakes, or that substance abuse, or harm people through medical malpractice, or whatever. It's sort of a range of different criteria. And what we find is that most boards do not do a very good job of policing doctors. And typically, the reason is A, they don't have enough money. B, it's often the doctors themselves that control the board, or the board has a very close association with the medical society in the state. And it's a club, in a sense, and people don't want to rock the boat. And I've talked to lots of hospital administrators who say they have a very hard time even getting rid of bad doctors. They say the bad doctors threaten to bring a lawsuit against us for wrongful termination. And they don't want to go through the hassle, and so what they'll do is quietly let that doctor go, and they won't give him a bad reference when they move on to the next hospital or the next state. It's crazy.
Again, I thank the last call. Let's go to Urbana number three for someone else right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is, are you saying court, C-O-U-R-T, or are you saying tort, T-O-R-T, and what the heck does that mean?
It's tort with a T, and maybe actually probably Mr. Clementi, that might be a good idea again to just for anybody who's not sure what it is we're talking about to very quickly run over what a tort is. People who are familiar with the law, of course, they know that term, but to everybody else, we don't talk about torts. Maybe the thing that people do talk about is personal injury lawsuits, and
yeah,
that's what people get.
Does that tort word come from?
Oh, it's a I think it's a Latin word. I actually don't know the derivation of it. I can't tell you exactly where it's from. I think it's Latin.
Well, in any sense, though, just for to answer the question's caller, do you think, in shorthand, the term that people will understand is if you say personal injury lawsuit, that's what we're talking about?
That is what we're talking about. Yes, it's. I mean, businesses bring torts too. That's not personal injury. That's the business being harmed. But right now what we're referring to is when the president talks about tort reform or the business community talks about tort reform, they're talking about the lawsuit that you as an individual brings against a doctor for medical malpractice, a hospital, or an HMO, or a drug company, or a business that you think stole money from you, or a car company that manufactured a defective product and you're trying to get compensation because you were injured by that defective product. It's those kinds of cases. Or people bring a case against a tobacco company because they were deceptive about addiction issues. I mean, those are all personal injury lawsuits against these companies, and they're called torts.
All right. Again, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We're pretty much at the point here we're going to have to stop. I'm with much more to be discussed, and I am sure that we will be hearing more about these issues next year and that we'll have some more discussion of them here on the program. As an earlier caller mentioned, there have been various states that have instituted some of these reforms. And in fact, the package that I believe is being discussed and endorsed by the administration, it's modeled after tort reform that was enacted in California back in the mid-70s. So various places they have dealt with this on a state-by-state basis. The administration has said, the president has said, this is very important, we want this to happen, but the wheels grind fine, they grind exceeding slow in the Washington, or maybe it's the other way around. Do you think that it's likely that we actually will see some changes made on the national level?
I think on the medical malpractice issue, I think it's very difficult to see how they get the votes to cap damages, at least at the levels that they've been talking about. We had 49. The other side, the pro cap members were 49 out of 100 in the last Senate. They may have gained three or four more votes, but it's still short of the 60 votes they need to cut off debate. And folks in Illinois, Senator Dick Durbin, who's now in the leadership, he's a major fighter for patient and consumer rights in Congress. He actually single-handedly stood on the floor last Congress, on the Senate floor, and debated for hours the other side, and was phenomenal in terms of his knowledge and his ability to rebut the claims made by the other side. So folks in Illinois should be very proud of his work.
All right. Well, and in response, by the way, to the question of the caller about tort, I am told, I'm not quite sure of the source, but I am told that tort comes from French. It's the French word for wrong, and that it was put into use via the English common law. So there you have it. We want to thank you very much, Mr. Clementi, for talking with us. Again, for people who are interested in reading the position of Public Citizen on these issues, you can look at their website, which is www.citizen.org. Also, if you're interested in hearing the interview that we did on November 30th with Sherman Joyce, president of the American Tort Reform Association, making the arguments for reform, you can go to our website. As long as you have internet access, it's will.uiuc.edu. And I'm sure we'll be talking about this some more in the future.